Hey, well, welcome everybody. We'll call this work session Los Angeles County Board of County Commissioners to order at this time. It is January 27th. It is 3 p.m. in the afternoon. Commissioner Haas, would you please lead us in invocation?
Yes, sir. Lord, we pray for those that are hurting, both known and unknown to us, because of these troubled times. We pray for peace, comfort, and healing, and the Holy Spirit to guide us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Mr. Lopez, will you please lead us in the pledge?
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, gentlemen. Roll call, please.
Commissioner Haas.
Here.
Commissioner Felix Lopez.
Here.
Commissioner Luis Lopez.
I am here. And do we have any changes to the agenda?
No changes to the agenda, Commissioner.
Motion to approve, please.
Make the motion to approve the agenda as presented.
Second.
Commissioner Felix Lopez?
Yes.
Commissioner Haas?
Yes.
Commissioner Luis Lopez?
Yes. And right to item A, discussion with COGC Commissioner Mr. John Mesner. I believe this meeting was facilitated shortly this week, put together, I believe, with Commissioner Felix Lopez and Mr. Mesner. So at this time, Mr. Mesner, thank you for convening with us, and you have the floor, sir.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it, Commissioner. And, you know, really, I'm just wanting to have a conversation with you all informally and just check in with you. We've gone through the mission change rulemaking in the fall through the COGCC. You know, Los Angeles County was an active participant, you know, in that rulemaking, as well as some operators from your area, which I appreciate. And then check in with you about a future rulemaking that's upcoming around financial assurances, and just solicit some thoughts and inputs on that particular topic. And so, you know, really, I think, first of all, thank you again for engaging in, you know, that rulemaking process. I mean, there was over 90 stakeholders that were involved in the rulemaking process for mission change. And that's not individuals, that's stakeholders. And so, you know, one stakeholder, you know, could have been 25 different entities, 180 hours of testimony, you know, thousands of pages of information that was provided, you know, from all the different parties and stakeholders that were involved. And, you know, I know that some people were happy with the result of it. Some people were frustrated with the result of it. Some people were somewhere in between. But nonetheless, we were able to finalize that rulemaking. And starting January 15th, the new rules came into effect. And so all new oil and gas operations permits are now going through the new rule process and being processed through the new rule process. The commission board will start seeing some of those permit applications and start reviewing some of those permit applications over the next 60 days. Most of the applications that were in the pipeline, you know, had to be resubmitted in the new format. You know, COGCC staff's working with operators to, you know, reformat those permits, and operators are prioritizing the permits that they're putting into the system right now. You know, prior to these new rules, it was pretty standard practice for operators to just put permits into the pipeline, whether they really wanted them or not, which did end up, you know, having, you know, 2,500 to 5,000 permits in the pipeline at any given time. Now they're reevaluating and putting permits through that are their highest priority, and then, you know, working through that system in that way. You know, ultimately what we landed on as far as the new rules is a performance-based land use process, not unlike what you see at the county level in most counties, with the COGCC commission being the planning commission, or both the planning commission, you know, and the county commissioners, the COGCC staff, you know, working with applicants to ensure that the application process is met and the applications are submitted with a recommendation from the director for either approval with conditions, or denial, and then those ultimately get reviewed by the COGCC commission, where again they're able to either choose to agree with the director's recommendation or seek conditions of approval or deny a particular application should it choose to. You know, I think, like I talked to you guys about a year ago, you know, SB 19-181 does give local governments the ability to have their own land use process for oil and gas development for surface impacts. The COGCC, through the rulemaking process, you know, indicated both in rule and in word that we're committed to working with local governments to facilitate that process so that an operator doesn't have to go through, you know, multiple different levels of review in order to be able to get something approved. Although ultimately we defer to the local government as far as how they want to see that process go. Some local governments are going to want to see that done sequentially, which means the local government wants to be the first one to permit and then it goes to the state. Some local governments are going to want to see that happen consecutively, where the COGCC and the local government work concurrently to review that particular application so that the operator is able to get a decision from both entities quicker. And so certainly I think we're committed to working with each individual local government jurisdiction to come up with a system that works best for them. And so that's kind of my overall like update about it, although I'm happy to answer any questions that you guys may have about the process and what we're doing moving forward.
If I may, Commissioner Isner, sure. What's the timeline? Does it look like it's going to be changed anyway with this new process for the applicant?
Timeline as far as getting approved?
Correct, or denied, either one.
Well, I mean, I think it's just like with any land use change that you guys run into. It depends on the complexity of the application, right? So if you've got an application that is complete and the applicant has, you know, done the alternative location analysis, they've, you know, looked at, you know, different impacts and they've got a pretty low impact site, then my guess is that application moves through fairly quickly. If it's a complex, you know, multi-well site close to a subdivision, or significant water body, or there's an endangered species that happens to be, you know, right next to it, then it's going to be more complicated and it could take longer. But I don't see this being a particularly onerous process. There's just more narratives that need to go along with it, explaining how they're going to meet the different standards that were developed through the rulemaking.
Okay. Now, another question I have, with these rules being implemented statewide, and then what does the COGCC side of it see, or financial side of it see, the decrease in revenues for our Department of Local Affairs, or have you even addressed that issue at this time?
I mean, there was a cost benefit analysis that was done, you know, as is required by statute for any rulemaking. And so, you know, based on that cost benefit analysis, and I can get that to you. I don't have it right now and I don't remember exactly what the conclusions were from it. But they do anticipate, you know, a potential impact from the new rules. However, it's also anticipated that production statewide will continue to climb. And so at this point, depending on, of course, what happens with the price of oil and gas. And, you know, a lot of this has so much to do with market conditions. So that'll end up having a big influence on whether production will continue to rise or not. But at least for the near future, the predictions are that production will continue to rise to higher levels than, you know, before the pandemic.
Thank you, Mr. Misner. We'll open up to our commissioners here. Commissioner Felix Lopez.
Thank you, John. Thank you so much for this opportunity. And again, thank you for reaching out. Always appreciate you keeping us in the loop. And I was just thinking it was about a year ago that we began to plan going to Washington, D.C. And you and I hung out up there, and it was quite an opportunity to get to know one another. So thank you for that. One of my two questions. One is for the approval, the sequential approval between COGCC and counties. Is there going to be a liaison between us and COGCC to by region, by county? How is that going to work, John?
I mean, we're working out some of those details right now. I mean, there is going to be a liaison, and so certainly there'll be a staff liaison between the COGCC and your local government designee. As far as working out some of the details. And then more than likely, I'm going to be your commission liaison at the county level so that, you know, as we start to work out these sequential processes, then I'm going to be the one that will, if you're going to do it sequentially, then I would be the one that would work with you in order to, you know, figure out a process that would work best. I mean, in the sequential process, really the liaison will be more likely a staff level position, because they're going to be the ones that will advise you, at least from the state level, what the operator needs to do in order to meet the standards. You, of course, as a local government, can choose whatever standards you want to require to the operator. And you have the ability to require less stringent standards than the state. However, the operator has to get approval from both the local government and the state. So even if you guys come in with less stringent standards, that means the operator could get approved by the local government, but they still need to meet the state standards as well. So both of us, you know, the operator has to meet both of our standards. Does that make sense?
In one of the conversation you and I had yesterday, John, when it comes to the financial impact, as far as bonding for operators within the county, is there any flexibility in there? And can you walk us through the process for an operator that is actually renewing their process and from the bonding perspective and also from the liability insurance perspective, both at the county and state level?
I mean, there's a current process that happens right now. That current process, you know, depending on what they're doing, they're required to have a certain amount of financial assurance of bonding. And it's pretty, generally speaking, from a land use perspective, it's a pretty nominal amount. It's around, I mean, if it's on a per well basis, it's 20,000, approximately 20,000 per well site. And, you know, that bond would be in place until the end of the well, end of life of well, which could be 30 years, but that would, if for some reason the operator went bankrupt or walked away from the asset, then that money would be utilized to complete any plugging or abandoning or reclamation or environmental cleanup necessary with, end of life of that well. What's being found, because we've got, you know, a significant backlog of orphaned wells in the state now, is that financial assurance that has traditionally been required is not enough to meet those end of life requirements. It's not enough to do the plugging and abandoning. It's not enough to do the reclamation or the environmental cleanup. And so there's two different things that are going to be looked at in the financial assurance rulemaking as far as what needs to be addressed. And there's no direction right now. There's no clear path forward. It's literally starting now, having discussions to see what the best path forward would be. But one is, how do we address this backlog of orphaned wells that, you know, are currently out there that need to be addressed plugged, abandoned, and properly reclaimed? And then how do we ensure that any permits that we are approving moving forward, you know, has those financial assurances in place so we don't have this problem in the future? Now, you know, like we do at the county level, you know, most of the time when there's a subdivision or, you know, land use change and industrial application, there's some development improvement agreement that occurs. There's some bonding that occurs, you know, to ensure that the developer is going to do what they say that they're going to do. And then that developer would get that money released as they go further and further down the process. It's different with oil and gas because really the expense that is borne by the oil and gas that you're bonding for isn't until end of life. That end of life could be 30 years down the road. And so, you know, taking a traditional land use approach of like development improvement agreements wouldn't really work with oil and gas development because you would be tying up so much capital that it would be financially infeasible for these operators to be able to continue to move forward. And so we're trying to come up with creative ways to still meet the obligations that we have to ensure that operators, you know, have financial assurance, but to do it in a way that, you know, isn't problematic for their operations. And so there's a few different approaches that we're looking at. You know, we're looking at some of the ways that EPA approaches it, either through RCRA or through the Underground Storage Tank Fund, where there's different ways for operators, five different ways for operators in order to meet that financial assurance demand. Some of it's, you know, trust funds, some of it is bonding, some of it's insurance, but in a blanket bonding approach where depending on how many wells they operate, they would have to have a different tier of blanket bonding. That would be a static bond for as long as they operated within the state of Colorado. There's another approach that's being considered that is a state assurance fund. So again, it would be replicated after the Oil and Public Safety Division at the state of Colorado, which is underground storage tanks for gas stations and such, where there would be a production fee that would go into a fund to basically self-insure oil and gas operators around the state, and operators then would be able to access those funds and get reimbursed for any expenses associated with plugging, abandoning, reclamation, or environmental cleanup, you know, for their operations. And so while they pay into it, they're also able to get paid out of it to do these end of life processes, either on their own facilities or, you know, a lot of these operators, the bigger operators, are actually doing environmental cleanup and plugging, abandoning on vertical wells, old vertical wells that are not even their own. And so that's another consideration that's being considered right now. Certainly that consideration between how a local government wants to assure financial assurance and how the state does it is an important conversation as well, because you don't want to double hit these operators. You know, if a local government has a process that they're going to require, you know, financial assurance, and it meets the same parameters as, you know, what a state financial assurance requirement would be, you know, do we defer to the local government at that point? I mean, these are some of the questions that we're trying to work out right now.
Yeah, and I think, thank you so much. That was going to be my next question, is how do we get kind of a cheat sheet to put the financial assurances that the state is requiring versus the ones that the local government, so we're on the same page, and you're absolutely correct. What the last thing we want to do is impact them more than they could have already had. So I look forward to working with COGCC staff and at the local level so we can understand exactly what communication we need to have with the producers. But then my next question is going to be, John, what is the relationship between COGCC and all the producers within Colorado? I mean, and that's probably a tough question to answer. But what I'm referring to, the understanding of the new rulemaking how to operate within the state of Colorado and the clarity of the guidance of those rules. And then should they apply for a, at the local level, as you say, sequentially, and there is a denial for some reason, is there the appeal process? Is it given the steps for them to go back and get back into the pipeline again and reapply for that particular well?
Sure. I'll answer your first question first. So, I mean, as far as, you know, providing guidance and instruction for operators in order to make sure that they understand the expectations of the new rules and, you know, are working so that they're able to, you know, work within the parameters now over the last month and will continue for the next few months. There's twice a week operator trainings that are occurring on Tuesday and Thursday mornings. Starting at 9, I think, going until about 10:30 or 11. And it's going through all the different revisions of the new forms and what operators need to do in order to submit the different things. And so operators around the state, you know, I've been on those twice a week, and there's typically between 200 and 300 people participating in those from around the state, asking questions and getting clarification. And so those will be ongoing. Inevitably there's going to be, you know, more questions than that can be fit in, you know, an hour and a half training. And so the different, you know, regional staff from the COGCC is working with the regional operators and making sure that there's, you know, understanding and clarity around it. And I think everyone understands that this is the biggest change in the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission since its inception. And so there's going to be some hurdles. There's going to be some hiccups as we roll out these new rules, but I think both operators and staff are, you know, working pretty closely together to just find a way to make it work. And so second question was what? Remind me again.
Yeah, the second question is, in the event that an operator gets denied,
oh, that's right,
what are the steps for them to appeal? Maybe they overlooked a parameter, a regulation, whatever the case might be. What are the steps for them to follow, and is the clarity of them? And then I think Commissioner Luis Lopez asked the question, how long of a process would it take for them to get back on the pipeline to get their permit approved?
Right. And I assume you're denied at the state level, not at the local level, right?
Correct.
Yeah. And so, I mean, really the goal is to work with an operator during the application process to not have to get to a denial. And so, you know, the pre-application consultation process ends up becoming a really important piece there. So they're encouraged to do a pre-consultation process with COGCC staff and the director. They're encouraged to do a pre-consultation process with local governments or special districts, Colorado Parks and Wildlife, CDPHE, you know, U.S. Geological Survey. I mean, a number of different entities to make sure that they understand what they need to do before starting the application. And then in the development of the application, they can continue to work with staff, and staff's going to be honest with them if there is a problem with the application that may or may not be able to meet the standards. Then staff is going to let them know that. Now, the applicant certainly has the ability to continue that application all the way to the end and get a decision from the COGCC commissioners as far as whether or not to approve that. But certainly the goal would be to make modifications in the site location or the best management practices or the mitigation measures, you know, or, you know, all these different elements, stormwater management plan, you know, prior to it getting to a decision point to get to a denial. Now, if they go through the process and they get a denial, they certainly can go back and reapply. I mean, assuming that they would go back and make modifications or adjustments to whatever the particular elements of that permit were that caused the denial. But just like, you know, if someone was, you know, an applicant for a subdivision in Los Animas County and they got to you guys and you denied them, That does, they could go back and reapply, right? I mean, they can go through the process as many times as they want. I mean, you assume that they're going to make modifications to it so they don't get the same answer over and over again, because it's a pretty resource-intensive process to go through a permit. But they certainly can do that.
Mr. Mesner, thank you. Sure. Knowing that produced water, and I'm speaking on behalf of our constituents, to me that's the elephant in the room. I'm concerned about if there's going to be some leniency here in Los Animas County. You heard the arguments about the water and how our water is much different than what is in Weld County. And I appreciate the fact that there be an application process. Could you walk me through that? I mean, how would that look to you?
Well, right now, we heard loud and clear from Los Animas County and the operators within Los Animas County the difference in the produced water quality, you know, down there than there was in Weld County or Rio Blanco County or other parts of the state. And that it ends up being a pretty important environmental benefit, you know, to landowners around these oil and gas operations. And so, you know, I personally had conversations with a number of people about it. We talked about it during the rulemaking. It was definitely a point of conversation. And so I think through the rulemaking process, with that under consideration, there were exceptions put in there to allow for that to be exempted based on testing of the water, right? So, I mean, you test the water and it's good, then you're exempt, right? If you test the water and it's got contaminants or pollutants in it, then it would have to go through the regulatory process that is in place in the rules. But there was an exemption built in there specifically for some of the comments around what was happening in Los Animas County, that you would, you know, if you were able to test that and it tested to a level, and I don't remember, there's a table and I can send you the table. I don't remember exactly what's in the table, but it has to do with dissolved solids and other, you know, other potential pollutants like, you know, benzene and toluene and, you know, some of the nasty stuff, but then dissolved solids end up being a big part of it as well. But as long as it met and whatever the lower thresholds were in that table, then that particular produced water pit would be exempt.
Thank you.
Yeah. Dornkamp, do you have any questions for Mr. Mesner?
Yes, you mentioned at the first of this meeting, financial assurance rulemaking was next on the docket. Is there a draft of those? Okay.
No, I mean, that's why I was reaching out to Commissioner Lopez is, you know, right now we're just having informal conversations to hear folks' thoughts, get ideas, start to develop some of that into the next step, which would be a stakeholder process in order to develop a draft. And then there would be that draft developed in anticipation of the rulemaking. But there, no one's landed on any of the right path forward yet.
When do you anticipate this taking place?
I mean, we had talked about, we don't have it on the docket yet. We talked about having it end of March or April. I think we're waiting right now to kind of see the staff capacity as they continue to roll out the new guidance and the new forms and the new processes from the previous rulemaking. We want to make sure that we don't overburden them as and just dive straight into this new rulemaking. But if everything goes smoothly, I would assume that we would be looking at it in the spring. So I would say anywhere from April to June, I guess.
I've been talking with some of the operators, and I apologize to the commissioners because I didn't get information sent to them like I thought I'd be able to, but they have concerns about the temporary abandoned wells, I believe, mm-hmm. that the bonding time frame may be reduced from where it's at now. And I heard two different times 2 years and 1 year down to 6 months. And I know one of our operators here in Los Angeles County that's drilling into the Raton Basin, which is the good water. Right. They have concerns about a 6 month bonding time frame, because their idea is on their TNAs to get those wells back into production, but it's going to take them a longer time than 6 months to go in and do the work that they need to do in those existing holes to get those back into production. So there's a good chance that they're going to end up losing their bond, 2,000, 4,000. I've heard both of those numbers thrown around, if they don't get it done in a 6 month time frame. So their pitch to us is to talk to the GOCC about perhaps extending that, if it is indeed the talk right now, 6 months, to put that out to a year, year and a half.
Yeah, that's not the first time I've heard that. And I mean, there is a time frame associated with temporary abandoned wells, right? And so those are wells that have the ability to go into production or be plugged, depending on what an operator wants to do. Operator will put those into that status, you know, if that well isn't financially productive at the time, or prices are too low, or they just want to pause production. But then there is an associated timeline with that from the COGCC standpoint that some operators abuse, that they just put them in that temporary status, and then they never get back to either putting them back into production or doing the necessary reclamation to plug and abandon those. And so there was a timeline that was put into place to encourage those operators that were just using it as a way to not have to do the plug and abandon or those things. But then there are operators that are, you know, really do want to put them back into production and need a little more time. And so last conversations I had with staff on this topic was that they were looking at ways in order to be able to offer extensions on those for operators that really were needing to have some extra time in order to put them back into operation. And so I think that there's some flexibility and understanding that needs to happen, but they are going to have to show, you know, true intent that they intend to put them back into operation versus just delaying the inevitable because they don't have the resources available right now to plug and abandon it. You know what I mean?
Okay.
Yeah.
It was also comments about the testing that is required. I believe it's going to be 3 sequential years of testing of the water coming out of the wells, even though our operators in this area, they already have data for those tests. And I guess that's not going to be considered in lieu of the 3 sequential years of testing, because the testing they're telling me is costing $625, $650 a test. And 2,000 wells or 4,000 wells, whatever you got in the county down here, that starts impacting an operator pretty heavily.
Sure. I have to go back to the rules, Mr. Dornicat, because I can't remember exactly how many times they had to test before they were exempt. But there was the intent, and it had something to do, and I'll get back to you on it to be sure, because I do have to go back and review it. But it had to do with if there was like a major change in operations. So, you know, once you got your baseline water quality, then you would be exempt unless you had a major change in operation. So you added 3 or 4 more wells, or, you know, I can't remember exactly what the different changes in operations would be, but if there was a significant change in operations, then you would need to do additional tests. But there was initial tests that had to be done for existing operations in order to gain that exemption. And I don't recollect the number 3, but I could be wrong too. So let me go back and review that and get back to you on that one.
All right. And then you mentioned, and I'm going to butcher this, but one of the 5 different ways of putting assurances, financial assurances together And one of them was like a state assurance fund, I believe you called it, similar to like the underground storage tanks for fuel. Is the thought there to assess a fee, a similar fee across the board, or is the CODC going to be looking at terrain? Because in my simple way of thinking, if a well is put on the side of a mountain, a well site, the reclamation cost for that is going to be a lot more than the reclamation cost for something out here in the flatlands of our county. Is that being kicked around, or is it just going to be a straight fee? Since I could understand it'd be really onerous for one of your staff to come and say, okay, we're going to charge this well site more on the side of the hill versus one out there on the flatland. What's your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think those are the things that need to get worked out, right? And I don't think there's any clear, clear path forward. I think that there has to be a determination of like an average of what it costs to, you know, do these end of life reclamations and plugging and abandoning in order to determine the fee that you're going to charge. But then I think operators get reimbursed based on, you know, what it actually costs to do the work at end of life, right? Because some of them are going to be easy. They're a single well that has half an acre of surface disturbance with no leaking or environmental cleanup around it. And that one's going to be significantly less than, you know, a 20 well pad that has had some leaking and has a 13 acre surface disturbance. Right. But I do think that those are some of the things that are trying to get worked out right now. The Small Operators Society, which is an oil and gas organization, you know, for those smaller operators, is proposing this as one of the ideas. And they have come up with, I think, a pretty interesting metric to use as far as what that production fee would be and how it would get reimbursed to operators. And so there's some different ideas that are being thrown out there. But at this stage, we're really just soliciting more ideas and more considerations like the one you just brought up as far as determining and refining this idea so that when we go into these formal stakeholder groups, we're able to, you know, work out more of the details on a couple of ideas rather than having, you know, 15 ideas out there going into a stakeholder process.
Okay, Commissioner, I guess with that, I don't have any other questions. Thank you, Mr. Mesman.
Sure.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Mesman, for being on the call today. I think that information that you're giving us today is going to benefit us quite a bit. If you can get that information to Mr. Dorenkamp, especially the financial assessment that plan that you guys discussed earlier, that would help us as commissioners tremendously. Us in our role, as you understand, we manage our counties annually by the revenues coming in, including in our oil and gas in this county.
Sure.
It's about one third of a lot of our revenue that comes in from that industry. So that'd be greatly appreciated so our administration, our financial administrator can move forward for next year's analysis and getting forward with possible losses of revenues or increases either way. So the only thing I would add was to Mr. Commissioner Hass's comment on the water. That was a big concern here, as you know. The qualifications, I think we meet a lot of those qualifications except for one that is the most difficult one, and that's the amoeba that is not local to the state of Colorado or to Los Angeles County. And I think that was one of the big hurdles that we've heard from our local producers. But that might be something that can be looked at. You mentioned we have more, we have some control here whether to lessen or tighten as long as the COGCC concurs with that producer. So I think we probably could be in a good spot moving forward to assist the county and our gas producers here. However, keep in mind, we don't represent the oil and gas industry. We represent Los Angeles County and right. The taxpayers. We want to make sure that they are safe and they have the resources coming in as well so we can operate this county properly. So sure. Do you have any closing comments, Mr. Mesner?
No, I don't. I appreciate that. I'll certainly get you the information that you've requested and that I mentioned I would send to you. And on the amoeba piece, and as far as working on site-specific situations, I mean, that was one of the things that was discussed pretty heavily through the rulemaking as well, is there's going to be site-specific, area-specific things that need to get worked out on the ground, right? And that's why we have a pretty thorough, you know, consultation process with like CPW, for example, for your water quality situation, where, you know, my understanding is that the benefit to wildlife and riparian habitats for that produced water was pretty significant. And if that was, you know, that you would consult with the local CPW office, and if they concurred with it, that would be, you know, a pretty significant factor in making some of those determinations, right?
If they didn't concur, Mr. Mesner, you had mentioned that the county could evaluate that and approve lesser restrictions than what the state qualifications are?
Well, you guys are allowed to approve lesser regulations, but that doesn't mean the operator doesn't have to meet the state standards, right? So it's almost... you could do it, but it doesn't make any difference because the state's the operator still has to meet the state standards and the local standards. You know? So, I mean, it doesn't take your authority away for having lesser standards, but the operator still has to meet both standards, right? So,
it's kind of pointless then.
It's a little bit. We're on the record, so I'm not going to say that.
And thank you, Commissioner Hasby, because that was when you made the comment, John, Mr. Mesner, that they've got to meet both standards. Well, I exactly read between the lines and a little bit redundant, but thank you for that.
I mean, the easy way to think about it is that the state regulations are the floor. Local regulations can be stricter. Technically, local regulations can't be.
Yeah, we don't want to build a basement.
In semantics, right? So that's kind of where you're at. That's right.
Yeah. John, you have our contact info, and really thank you for reaching out to us, and we'll be in contact with you and looking forward to open discussion and rationale with a lot of common sense going forward.
That sounds good. You guys have a great rest of the week, and I appreciate the conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks.
At this time, we'll entertain a motion to adjourn, please.
I move to adjourn.
Second.
Mr. Luis Lopez?
Yes.
Mr. Haas?
Yes.
Mr. Luis Lopez?
Thanks, everybody. Have a good day.
Thanks for that question, Tony.